Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming for the third and final day of the what we hope will be the first of many Codex Foundation symposiums and Codex book fairs. This has been so far so good, as the some people think, like to say. We hope that by the end of the evening and we've all gone home, that there will be no surprises. There has been a very relaxed week for me. And I've really enjoyed doing, playing the host. Our speaker this morning, Robert Bringhurst, is a Canadian who hails from my home ground. In fact, in his newest suite of essays, he says in the preface that his mind was formed on Rock Creek, and Rock Creek is probably one of the greatest salmon fly hatcheries in western Montana, where the great Wiley brown trout has grown to magnificent proportions and has been feeding the families of people in the Clark's Fork of the Columbia River Valley for generations and hundreds and thousands of years, most likely. And it turns out, I didn't know that Robert and I, who are roughly the same age, may have bumped into each other on that creek as children. I was quite happily surprised. But Robert's accomplishments are many. He got off the trout stream eventually and found his way into the greater stream of literature and language and typography and translation and poetry and cultural studies. The world that we all inhabit is a world that Robert is at home in. He's a scholar, he is a writer, and yet he is a bookman in the hands-on sense. When you hand Robert a book to look at, often you have to be careful what you do. He might read it from cover to cover before he moves, if it's a shortish sort of book. His typographic knowledge is deep because he practices typography as a discipline. And his knowledge of our inner workings seems to be deep because he shares an abiding interest in the history of our lives and the history of our crafts and the history of our endeavors, and then also is involved very directly with our futures, because in yet another hat that Robert wears is there's a sort of a diplomatic side to him, and he will at any given moment, he could be speaking in Arabic in Turkey, or he might be in Mexico City delivering a lecture on indigenous literature, or he might be in Italy, meeting the translator of his book, who's going to be spreading the typographic word sort of in an international style that is, of course, originates in Western Canada. Can you imagine that? On a small island or in a big city. Anyway, without much further ado, I would like to introduce our final speaker, solo speaker, Robert Bringhurst.
Thank you very much. I would like to say it's been a great pleasure to me to be here. Could you turn that thing on, please, so we can get a little visual prologue going here? Thank you. I don't get to hang out with book artists nearly as much as I would like to. I have to spend a lot of my time with rocks and trees, or even better company than human beings. And a lot of it with people who work in the hard and cruel world of trade publishing. It's been a great pleasure to loaf around with the book artists for a few days and to handle such beautiful objects and meet old friends and many new ones. I especially want to thank Peter and Susan and everybody else who has made this conference possible. and to thank them for arranging it in February. The weather in Berkeley is considerably sweeter than the weather where I live at this moment in the year. It's not so all around the year, but it's certainly true now. I'm going to try to make this machine disgorge my talk because only it knows what I'm supposed to say. But while that's happening, let me tell you one other secret. There are two poets whom every printer in California hopes to print, or hopes to print again, if he or she has done it already. Those are Robinson Jeffers and Gary Snyder. Robinson Jeffers is not here today, even though we invited him. Gary Snyder is here, so we're all graced by the presence of the literary spirit of this place in his person. Oh, I need something that tells me what to say. Where is it? It's not there. Anyway. It's on this one. No, I have it here. Thank you. I just never quite learned how to use one of these machines. That's the problem. Can we make that go away? Yes, thank you. All right. Art history and natural history are practiced very differently at present, and I would like you to consider the possibility or the certainty that these are two ways of looking at the same thing, or that they are two panes. Stop that. Get out of here. Thank you. Two panes of the same window set in the same imaginary wall. Letter forms and the speech sounds that letters represent seem to me a lot like footprints, seashells, pine cones, squid quills, antlers, fallen leaves, and other often. Thank you. Is that better? Is it better? Good, thank you. Fallen leaves and other often lively but lifeless artifacts produced and left behind by living beings who may or may not be conscious of what they are doing. A lot of people insist that art and language are the property of human beings alone, but for me, the study of letter forms and the study of art and literature in general leads to the discovery that we as human beings have an awful lot in common with other species on the planet. It doesn't support the illusion that we are somehow more important or smarter or more valuable than mosquitoes or brook trout or red cedar or snails. All living things have form. They have geometry. But their geometry is animate, it's organic, it flexes, it breathes. Like the sophisticated geometry of these snails who climbed onto a pot of geraniums on the porch of the old cabin that I lived in for many years on Bowen Island off the BC coast. Humans are proud of their ability to kill and proud of their ability to make things that are well and thoroughly dead. Steel and concrete and straight lines and right angles, for example. But then, of course, because they are alive, humans take what they've made and try to give it life again by turning steel ingots into graceful, flexible palette knives and sword blades, for example, and concrete into garden walls and straight lines and right angles into tea houses and temples and books and into Greek borders like the one on that flower pot. And into Socratic dialogues, and into pure, disembodied, but lively ideas. I hope you like looking at snails. I've seen some books in the past few days that are every bit as beautiful as this old red flower pot, though maybe not quite as useful. And I've seen a few books that at least aspire to be as beautiful as these snails. But I haven't seen any that are more beautiful than that. When Ludwig Wittgenstein died in 1951, he was working on a book about philosophy and music. And among the notes and drafts for that book is a scrap of paper bearing the sentence, "Das Buch ist voller Leben, nicht wie ein Mensch, sondern wie ein Ameishaar." The book is full of life, not like a human, but like an ant. This is a sweet idea. Think of the books on your shelves being full of life like that, the images and the ideas crawling around in the dark, mating and feeding and defending their turf against invading ideas from the books on either side. That's happening on your bookshelf right now, Peter, because you're not there to disturb them. And it's probably true that in most books, as in most anthills, most of the population is sterile. Most of the ideas are workers or slaves, and only a few ideas have wings and can give birth to thousands more. Most books, even the best books, are probably more like anthills than they are like snails. Maybe that's good. I'm not excited myself by the goal of making books that can reproduce themselves without human intervention. But I haven't seen very many anthills as colorful or shapely as these snails. Maybe that's just because I don't know enough about how to look at anthills, or because the really interesting parts of them are difficult for me to see. I do know, however, that shapeliness is important, something we look for in books and in ideas, just as we do in snails. We record ideas in drawings and paintings and diagrams and mathematical and musical notation and in words. Words themselves are invisible. We try to capture their traces in writing and capture the writing in type. And type is something you can see as well as something you can hold in your hand. And if you can see the type clearly enough, you might just start to hear the words. And if you hear the words clearly, you might just begin to see the ideas that call them into the air. And when you can see the ideas clearly and the shapes they form, maybe you'll say they approach the condition of music, which is just as invisible as words. And when the music you can hear by looking at the ideas is equally clear and beautiful, maybe you'll say that it approaches the condition of mathematics, which is something you can neither see nor hear. But usually what we mean when we say that music approaches mathematics is that music embodies a perceptible geometry. And geometry is mathematics that you can see, and maybe even feel, and maybe even live in. Organic geometry is tactile, and geometry is present in snails and even in anthills. It would be better not to touch these snails. They prefer their company to ours. But when you see them, you know that they are tangible and tactile. So the thing to do is to make something you can touch, a book, for example, or a letter form, that's just as satisfying to be around and as satisfying to think about as a snail. These snails are living, breathing geometry. Geometry that can crawl around in the garden. Geometry that sings when it feels the presence of the rain. The calligrapher Yaqut al-Mustaqsimi lived in Baghdad about 750 years ago. He started life as a slave, like many ants. But before he was 30 years old, he was one of the most admired figures in the city. In 1258, on the Christian calendar, he saw his city wrecked by the Mongols, just as it's been wrecked by another invading army in recent years. That's not a political remark, of course. I didn't intend anything by that. But he continued to practice his art for 40 years after that invasion. Yaqut is the author of the sentence you see here, written out superbly by an American-born calligrapher named Muhammad Zakaria. The sentence says, "Al-khattu handasatun ruhaniyatun zakharat bi'aratin jismaniyat." Script is spiritual geometry made visible by a material instrument. the word hat, the first word in the sentence, which is over there in the bottom right-hand corner, means simply line in Arabic. A very simple, straightforward word. In modern Arabic, it could be a telephone line or a telegraph line or something as intangible as a line of descent or line in Euclidean geometry or a metaphorical line in the sand, or it could be a draftsman's line drawn with a ruling pen and a straight edge, but it also means the pen stroke, and so it is the usual way of saying calligraphy in Arabic. Every Arab street kid knows that word. Now you see something that's one of the differences between Arabic and English. We don't have a plain English word for the craft of making letters with a pen, so we have to use the fancy word calligraphy, beautiful writing, which street kids do not usually know. The Arabs just call it line or stroke. Maybe we could just call it pen work in English rather than calligraphy. Pen work is spiritual geometry made visible with a material instrument. But in Arabic, khat can also mean type, as in typography. So, in modern terms, this sentence also means typography is spiritual geometry made visible with a material instrument. The truth is, typography is usually not that good, but spiritual geometry is what typography could be, or could try to be. Maybe we could make some other good sentences using this one as a model. Maybe we could say, for instance, that music is spiritual geometry made audible by a material instrument. Or that the human body, like the body and shell of a snail, or the skeleton in the foliage of an Engelmann spruce, or a mountain larch, or a white bark pine, is spiritual geometry made tangible and visible by growth and reproduction. There's the same sentence set into type using a system recently devised by Tom Milo and Miriam Sommers in Amsterdam. It could look very handsome set in type, and for some of us at least, setting it in type can make it easier to read. This, in fact, is about as good as Arabic typesetting ever gets, or as good as it's got so far. But no typesetting system will do what the hand of a skilled calligrapher can do, especially with a multi-leveled, highly ductile script like this one, which is Nasr, the preeminent book script of classical Arabic. Typographic geometry is almost always a simplification of an underlying scriptorial geometry, and because it's a simplification, it often doesn't breathe as well as its scriptorial model. But both script and type can lose their breath, lose their stride, their geometry can wilt. Their breath can get snarled. The Sufi calligraphers who write painstakingly with liquid gum on the skeletons of rotted leaves appear to know a thing or two about the depth of the relation between botanical form and scriptorial form, between natural form and artificial form. This kind of work is very tedious and difficult to do, and the results are very, very delicate, but it does serve the purpose of keeping the scribes and the script in touch with botanical forms, botanical textures, botanical geometries. It's one way of calibrating the eye and the hand against the incredible geometries of the real non-human world. This very highly developed Ottoman script has some of the texture of thick growth in the forest or the garden, yet it's perfectly legible, perfectly clear. What the calligrapher does in a script like this is not so much to design something as to set an organic force in motion. And so the calligrapher's real job in a tradition like this is really just to make, not just to make things, but to sustain and nurture that organic force which is the heart and soul of the craft. A lot of people say that the geometry of things was here by divine fiat, perfect and complete in the beginning before there were any material forms, and that individual things and creatures, plants, animals, forests, temples, scripts are just trying their best to enact and embody it here in the fallen material world, failing at the task. I think what happens is that geometry grows in the womb of actual things and creatures, plants, animals, forests, temples, scripts, just the way skeletons and grammars and lexical systems grow inside real things. Grammars don't exist until they evolve in the languages they're part of, and neither do scripts or scriptorial geometries. So it seems to me that geometry isn't a timeless Platonic toolkit living in the mind of God prior to creation. It's something that grows and evolves through its own material manifestations. It needs a body in order to have a spirit, just as a grammar needs a language and love needs lovers. This particular piece, if we get a little closer, you can see the artist's signature coiled in the outline of a fig, the sweet fruit of many years of learning, built on many centuries of building a tradition. The earliest examples of Arabic script we have look like this. The geometry isn't there yet. It isn't there even in embryo. It not only hasn't yet been born, it hasn't even been conceived. What's happening at this stage in the life of a script is that would-be scribes are starting to build the soil in which a tradition, a culture, can eventually breed. The difference between this script and this one, for example, which is a script over the eastern door of the Topkapi Museum in Istanbul, the difference between those two is precisely geometry. In this archway, the geometry is magnified, exaggerated, of course, because the script is arranged as a mirror image of itself. But it's the geometry within the letter forms and the word shapes themselves that really matters. This is the panel underneath that archway, directly over the door, and there's no reflection here. The geometry is entirely within the letter forms and in the combinations and the interrelations that they create. In the 10th and 11th centuries, well before Yaqut al-Musta'simi was born, Arab calligraphers were trying to measure their own pen work and evaluate its proportions. Here's a Persian example as well. The thing to remember when you see analyses like this is that they are descriptive, not prescriptive. These measurements are often taught nowadays as if they were recipes for writing, but the writing comes first and the measurement comes after. The same thing is true for analyses of the underlying letter shapes. What you see here is a geometrical analysis of the structural contrast between the letter ha in the Arabic book script nasch on your left and the same letter in the Persian book script nastalit on your right. But this is not a geometrical rule telling calligraphers what they ought to do. It's just a geometrical analysis of what real calligraphers, people who nurture the tradition, have found that they must do. Same principle holds for geometrical analyses of Latin letter forms, whether they're made like this one by Geoffroy Thierry or like this one by Albrecht Durer. Thierry evidently thought that he was writing recipes. Durer knew perfectly well that what he was doing is analyzing and describing craft practice, not legislating it. And he knew that there was more than one workable solution to describe. He also knew there's more than one shape for the human head and more than one interesting posture for the human hand. Head and hand are two really interesting embodiments of organic geometry, which is just how Durer represents them. And Durer knew that books belong with heads and hands. He knew that books like hands and heads are embodiments of organic geometry and that they have to be calibrated against the real thing. Renaissance artists understood, by and large, that in a healthy society, art and science fuse. Vittore Carpaccio, who worked in Venice in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, made a lot of sketches of scholars and writers, poets at work. Many of these sketches are now, for some reason, in the Pushkin Museum in Moscow, and they show over and over again, like this one, a scholar surrounded by books and by measuring devices, and also often by archaeological finds, and also by windows, always windows for letting in the light. Careful measurement is important in the taxonomy of letter forms, just as counting teeth and toes and measuring ears and tails is of use in the taxonomy of mammals. Counting stamens is of use in the taxonomy of plants. And the study of proportions helps immensely in tracing the coevolution of structures and forms in different arts, typography and music, for example. If you accept that letter forms are life forms, or if you treat them as something like seashells, organic artifacts created and left behind by living creatures, then you can study their comparative anatomy, and then you begin to see their evolutionary history. And then it does become clear that art history really is a subdivision of natural history, and that the history of art is just a small subdepartment of biology, which is just part of the study of what is. This is a much more detailed sketch by the same artist, the preliminary sketch for a painting, which exists today in the same building for which it was made, the Scuola di San Rocco, and Scuola di San Giorgio, I'm sorry, in Venice. Painted in 1502 by Carpaccio, a portrait of the workroom of a literate, curious, thinking human being. This painting owes a good deal to another one made in fresco 20 years earlier by Sandro Botticelli in Florence. I want to show you some details of these paintings. If you look up behind St. Augustine's head there, you see a manuscript book, almost certainly a manuscript of Euclid, or possibly it's supposed to represent a printed book, except that in 1482, when this fresco was made, there was no printed book like that. You see the way the pages are laid out asymmetrically, with the text column on the right and the illustrations on the left in a narrower column, both on the recto and the verso page. There are manuscripts like that from the late 15th century, but no printed books laid out in that very modern way. And even though the book sitting next to it on the left there is closed, we know what kind of book it is because of its different proportions. Those fat proportions tell us that it's a Bible or a judicial book of some kind, a treatise on canon law, perhaps. Not a humanist text like the Euclid, which is on a taller, narrower page, a secular page, a humanist page, not a church page. The first printed edition of Euclid, issued by Erhard Ratdolz, appeared in 1482, 2 years after this fresco was painted, but the Greek text was not printed until 1533, and even then in a deplorable edition. In fact, there was no good Greek text of Euclid until the 19th century, when a good manuscript was found in the Vatican Library. Nevertheless, Botticelli and a lot of other people knew who Euclid was, and they knew they should be looking for a good Greek text. There's a detail of that sketch we saw earlier, and you see that up to the right of this gentleman's head, there is an empty circle waiting for something to happen. It's waiting for that. It's waiting for an armillary sphere. another secular device which maps the geometry of planetary movements. This sketch is the sketch of a real room in Venice, and the painting realizes the sketch in great detail, except evidently the armillary sphere wasn't there, and Carpaccio wanted one. He found it in Botticelli's painting, just about the same distance from St. Augustine's head. There's something like that armillary sphere, a map of another geometry, the circle of fifths. One of the secrets and one of the fruits of the system of equal temperament. This kind of musical geometry is first described and illustrated in a book by Johann David Heinichen, published in Vienna in 1728, but it encapsulates a principle that was known much earlier. One of the interesting things about this geometry is that it is imperfect. It's drawn here in a simple way with a ruler and compass as if it were intended to be perfect Euclidean geometry, but the circle of fifths doesn't work that way. To play real, true fifths, you get a logarithmic spiral like the snail shell. One of the secrets of logarithmic spirals is that they eventually collapse. They are the geometry of mortality. Snails cannot keep growing forever, nor pine cones, which are also built on the same principle. And the real circle of fifths can't keep growing forever either. You get non-canonical intervals. If you fudge a little bit, you can get a perfect Euclidean circle like this, the secret of equal temperament. So to make the geometry perfect, the music becomes impure. Or if you play the music purely on a fretless instrument like a violin or a cello, you get impure, that is, organic, natural geometry. Take your pick. You have to have impurity one way or another. That's one of the geometrical rules. I would pause now for a skill testing question. How many of you can identify the score in the background? No? That's part of a Haydn string quartet, favorite of mine. I thought some of you might know. You can't do typography unless you listen to music, preferably play it. You know, and the kind of music you play or listen to determines the kind of typography you will do, because geometry is contagious. Well, there is another attempt to do geometry. This is, of course, Geoffroy Thiery again, who I think was a believer in geometrical purity, although this is a fairly complicated structure. I mean, I think Thiery believed that letters could be geometrically perfect, which in my experience is not true, or if true, is lethal. You will notice, however, that this letter has some organic characteristic, particularly the oblique axis, the humanist axis, an angle of about 10 degrees, which is the angle of the pen held in the right hand of the scribe. Just that a real scribe wouldn't make it quite that perfectly elliptical. Well, if you put a letter like that to use, of course, it starts to tell stories. That's what letters want to do. And then its geometry becomes very complicated indeed. I'll show you this drawing by Giacomo Guardi, a drawing of the entrance to the Arsenale in Venice, so you can see a contrast between two different approaches to geometry. The geometry of that bridge is very simple and linear. Any apprentice carpenter could put that together with a hammer and nails. But if you look at the boats in the background, the gondola under the bridge and the workboat up against the wall of the canal, you see a much more sophisticated kind of geometry. This is a Esquero, a workyard in Venice where gondolas are made and repaired. I'll just walk you around the place a little bit so you can catch up with the geometry of that gondola that's sitting up on sawhorses. You see, it has the same oblique axis as that letter we were looking at a moment ago. In other words, this boat has something in common with this script, which is the script's cut. You all know this, right? You may not recognize Haydn when you see it, but you must recognize Nicolas Janson's Roman type, cut in Venice in 1469, used in Venice in 1470. Either this is based on the gondola or the other way around. I don't know which is which, but they have something in common. The axis of the letter forms, which is the axis of the pen held in the hand of the scribe. Why do they have something in common? Because a gondola is a one-sided boat. You put the oar, the pole, on one side of the boat, and you keep pushing on that side. And you have to push it, row it, steer it through narrow channels and tight corners. It has the axis of these letter forms, the axis of the pen. Not very different from the axis that Tully recorded in his drawing. And if you turn the boat around, or if you turn yourself around in the boat so that you can steer the thing instead of watching it come toward you, you will find that you have suddenly acquired the axis of a good Venetian italic. Some of you must know this, but the oarlock, the rullock that comes with the gondola is something much more complicated than an ordinary North American skiff, right? It is a very interesting piece of organic geometry with 8 different positions in the standard form. Here you see 3 of them. You can see the forcola itself, which is the oarlock for the gondola, in the center there, and that's the position of the oar that's used for normal forward motion, voga normale. On the left there, you see the position that's used for starting out, partenza, and on the right, voga all'indietro, the position for going in reverse. There are more, but I won't give you a complete lesson right now. This is another approach to nautical engineering. Design made by Francesco di Giorgio around about the same time that Carpaccio was making that wonderful painting we just looked at. Francesco is not interested in the organic beauty of the gondola. He's a mechanic. He's an inventor. He's a very dangerous kind of person who wants to turn the boat into a set of collapsible parts that can be packed on the back of a mule, or turn it into a great machine that can be rowed by turning a crank. This is ingenious, you know, but something's lost. The organic geometry is what's been lost. These boats belong in an edition of popular mechanics and not in Carpaccio's painting. This is the first Arabic edition of Euclid's, printed at the Medici Press in Rome in 1594 using some type cut by Robert Grandjean. A study in spiritual geometry. But, of course, Euclid would not have recognized this script. He would have recognized this script instead. This is the proof for the infinity of prime numbers. in Euclid, who, as you all know, writes about not only plane geometry but solid geometry and number theory. This proof is interesting to me, among other things, because of its importance to Arthur Koestler, who recalls in his autobiography the pleasures of thinking about Euclid while he was imprisoned as a spy during the Spanish Civil War. I will, if you don't mind, read you a section from that autobiography. "I was standing at the recessed window of cell number 40 with a piece of iron spring that I had extracted from the wire mattress and was scratching mathematical formulae on the wall. Mathematics, in particular analytical geometry, has been the favorite hobby of my youth, neglected later on for many years, and I was trying to remember how to derive the formula of the hyperbola, and I was stumped. Then I tried the ellipse and the parabola, and to my delight succeeded. Next I went on to recall Euclid's proof that the number of primes is infinite. Since I had become acquainted with Euclid's proof at school, it had always filled me with a deep satisfaction that was aesthetic rather than intellectual. Now, as I recalled the method and scratched the symbols on the wall, I felt the same enchantment. And then, for the first time, I suddenly understood the reason for this enchantment. The scribbled symbols on the wall represented one of the rare cases where a meaningful and comprehensive statement about the infinite is arrived at by precise and finite means. The infinite is a mystical mass shrouded in a haze, and yet it was possible to gain some knowledge of it without losing oneself in treacly ambiguity. The significance of this swept over me like a wave. The wave had originated in an articulate verbal insight, but this evaporated at once, leaving in its wake only a wordless essence, a fragrance of eternity, a quiver of the arrow in the blue. I must have stood there for some minutes, entranced, with a wordless awareness that this is perfect, perfect, until I noticed some mental discomfort nagging at the back of my mind, some trivial circumstance that marred the perfection of the moment. And then I remembered the nature of that irrelevant annoyance. I was, of course, in prison and might be shot. But this was immediately answered by a feeling whose verbal translation would be, so what? Is that all? Have you got nothing more serious to worry about? An answer so spontaneous, fresh, and amused, as if the intruding annoyance had been the loss of a color stud. And then I was floating on my back in a river of peace, under bridges of silence. It came from nowhere and flowed nowhere. There was no river and no I. The I had ceased to exist. When I say the I had ceased to exist, I refer to a concrete experience that is verbally as incommunicable as the feeling aroused by a piano concerto, and yet just as real, only much more real. In fact, its primary mark is the sensation that this state is more real than any other one has experienced before, that for the first time the veil has fallen and one is in touch with real reality, the hidden order of things, the X-ray texture of the world, normally obscured by layers of irrelevance. What distinguishes this type of experience from the emotional entrancements of music, landscapes, or love is that the former has a definitely intellectual, or rather noumenal, content. It is meaningful, though not in verbal terms. Verbal transcriptions that come nearest to it are the unity and interlocking of everything that exists, an interdependence like that of gravitational fields or communicating vessels. The I ceases to exist because it has, by a kind of mental osmosis, established communication with and been dissolved in the universal pool. It is the process of dissolution and limitless expansion which is sensed as the oceanic feeling, the draining of all tension, the absolute catharsis, the peace that passeth all understanding. That comes from Arthur Koestler, a book with a wonderful title, The Invisible Writing. Getting a little close to treacly ambiguities there, it seems to me. And the cure for that is to go back to Euclid himself. These are the first seven sentences of Euclid's Stoicheia, Elements. How clean, how clear. Se me honestin u meros utes, gramme de me cos aplates, grammes de perata se meia, and so on. The point is that which has no part. The old Greek word for point is semeion, which means seed. Seed. A point is a seed. See? You say that, it causes cell phones to ring. Yeah? A line is breadthless length. The extremities of a line are points. A straight line is a line which lies evenly with the points on itself. This is beautiful Greek. It is beautifully clear. It is Greek that Plato would be proud of, great Greek that Aristotle would be proud of. Beautifully clear. No treacle, no allusions to oceanic waves, any of that. But there might be some waves coming out of it. Let's go back and look at some more snails. I just want to show you now some more examples of organic geometry. Some of these come from the Northwest Coast, where I hang out most of the time. This is a fragment of a rattle made by Tlingit artists on the southeast coast of Alaska. A form arising out of another form, like a child being born from its mother, or a spirit coming out of the belly of someone who, in spite of himself, has to say something. And this is a stone bowl that came from the village of Kiusta in the Queen Charlotte Islands, made by a Haida artist. We don't know when, but it was acquired by a visiting European in the 1880s. Now in the McCord Museum in Montreal, a bowl that is both a frog and something like a human, who also appears to have something that he just has to say. Bill Reed, my Haida teacher, used to look at things like this and say they prove the stupidity of the Aristotelian claim that two things cannot inhabit the same space at the same time. This is a nice old wooden box, also made by a Haida artist, whose name we do not know. He was therefore called the Master of the Black Field. This box lives in the American Museum of Natural History in New York, but it was made off the coast of British Columbia by someone with a very sophisticated sense of organic geometry. This is pretty close to the sophistication of a really sophisticated book. And this is a silkscreen print made in recent years by the Haida artist Robert Davidson. Represents the boiled down form of a killer whale. Maybe you see that kind of organic geometry in this form too, a long pei made in China in the 10th century before Christ. Geometry that is also a representation of animal form, organic geometry. Maybe you see it here in a very different kind of organic geometry on the Phaistos jug made in Crete about 1800 years before Christ. The organic geometry in these objects is a lot easier to see, in my opinion, than it is in your ordinary book. Not that the Bible is exactly an ordinary book, but the geometry is that of the standard simple codex form. Nothing very artful going on here, as there was in that edition of Euclid designed by Sandro Botticelli. Still, it's a form that flexes and breathes, designed on a drafting table perhaps, but when it's actually built, it's built out of a flexible surface, a substance that shrinks and expands and flows and folds and rolls, paper. It moves very much like a human body. This building doesn't move in quite the same way, but it has a very sophisticated geometry made organic by constant reference to organic forms, seashells, for example, which Filippo Brunelleschi, the architect, was in love with. This is the Sagrestia Vecchia, the old sacristy in Florence, the family tomb of the Medicis. And this you may recognize as the Pazzi Chapel, also in Florence, attached to Michelangelo's parish church. This is somebody's attempt to map the geometry of the structure. It's a diagram of an X-ray diagram of the Pazzi Chapel, which someone has begun to try to decipher the proportions of the forms and to describe the way in which the rectilinear geometry is humanized by modeling, initially with curves and circles, and then with much more sophisticated forms, which, because they occur in three-dimensional space, are constantly shifting.